So it has become an incredibly hostile environment, and it's very hard to see how the situation will improve anytime soon.
Gjennom dokumentaren Martine, siste kapittel på TV 2, ble det norske folk kjent med BBC-journalisten Nawal al-Magafi. Den prisbelønte journalisten snakker om ytringsfrihetens kår i sitt hjemland Jemen, i dette opptaket fra Sølvberget i mars 2024. Dette var en del av vår temauke om landet Jemen.
First of all, I want to say thank you so much for having me. It is great to be in Stavanger. I hope I'm saying it properly. I've already learned so much about your beautiful city. I learned that it's the capital of freedom of expression in Norway. I also learned that I shouldn't eat anything outside because within moments of arriving, I bought the most glorious cinnamon bun and then a seagull snatched it from my hands. So it's safe to say I'll be eating indoors from now on whilst I'm here. But yes, thank you so much for having me. It is really, really great to see so many people interested in Yemen. It's made the journey here really worth it. So I'm really excited to talk to you guys about my homeland. Thank you for the lovely introduction. I'm Nawal al-Makafi. A lot of you know me from the documentary about the tragic killing of Martin Vik Magnusson. It's a case that I've been interested in for over a decade now, and so it was great to make that film with her father and to put it out over a year ago now, and I'd be happy to answer questions about it afterwards. But yeah, I mean, that's not the only piece of work that I've done in the last decade. You know, I'm originally Yemeni, so naturally I've done a lot of work on Yemen and the war that broke out there over the last decade. I've done investigations on the sexual abuse of young girls in Iraq, organ trafficking in Egypt, chemical warfare in Syria. I've traveled across the Middle East, and I'm so lucky that I get to, that my job is to travel and speak to people, and they welcome me into their homes and tell me very intimate stories. And I'm really excited to share some of them with you today. So today we're going to be talking about freedom of expression. And honestly, it really couldn't be more timely. Just before coming here today, I was watching this video of our Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, talking about the protests for Palestine in the UK and how they need to be shut down. And it made me think about how freedom of expression is being attacked, not only in underdeveloped countries, but is really being attacked across the world. And it's devastating to see. And so after watching that video by Rishi Sunak, I started looking into statistics on freedom of expression. And it's very depressing. You know, there was a report published last year that said, and this report, it measures freedom of everyone, regardless of their nature of work. It's not just about journalism. And it's about, you know, freedom to express opinions, beliefs, to communicate and to access information. And it revealed that the number of people living in countries that restrict freedom of expression is at its highest point in two decades, and that 80% of the global population has less freedom of expression than they did in the year 2000. I find that really depressing because we're at an age where so much information is at our fingertips, right, on our mobile phones. Not only that, but if we want to express ourselves, we're able to do it, you'd think, to such a wide array of people across the world, not just our neighbors and people around us. And the fact that there's a crackdown on freedom of expression means there are so many people around the world that are being persecuted for sharing their beliefs, sharing how they feel, sharing what they follow. And yeah, it's really sad. But I want to focus on Yemen today, not only because this whole week's theme is on Yemen, but because I'm Yemeni and because when I think about the last decade and my reporting on Yemen, to me, in my mind, it is a clear example of how the constraints on freedom of expression have increased and changed as political upheaval has changed in the country. So I'm going to be telling you stories from my journeys reporting in Yemen in the last decade. But I have to give you guys a disclaimer that I will miss out events that happened in the recent history in Yemen, because for those of you who do know about Yemen, you'll also know it's incredibly complicated, and I'd need to sit here for hours if I was to tell you every little detail. So I'll be focusing on stories that I witnessed firsthand from my journeys in the last year, in the last decade, sorry. So I grew up between the UK and Yemen. So I traveled to Yemen extensively throughout my childhood. But the first time I traveled to Yemen as a journalist was in 2011. And it was at the time where the Arab Spring broke out across the Middle East, and it spilled over to Yemen. And I was in my last year of university in the UK, and I really wanted to go and report from the protests that were happening in Yemen, in my hometown of Sana'a, this beautiful city that you can see behind me. The protests were against the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh. He'd been president for over 30 years, and it was against his autocratic regime. And to film, as soon as I arrived, I met with this cameraman in Change Square. Actually, it wasn't Change Square. The protests in Yemen happened in a long road in the capital city, Sana'a, because as soon as protests erupted in Egypt and Syria, President Ali Abdullah Saleh actually made sure his supporters filled and camped out on Change Square. So they took over Change Square. But there was a long road of protesters that were protesting against him. So as soon as I arrived, I went to that road and I met with this Yemeni cameraman called Mohammed Al-Mikhlafi. And I told him, you know, I'm here from the UK, I'm working as a freelancer, and I really want to film the protests, and I want to hear the stories of these people that are protesting against Ali Abdullah Saleh. And he said, do you have accreditation? And I said, no, we can't get accreditation, because how can we get accreditation from the government when we want to film stories about the people protesting against the government who want to overthrow the government? And he said, well, you can't film without accreditation, so we have to go to the ministry and get permission. And so we went to the Ministry of Information, and at the time, the Deputy Minister of Information was this wonderful man called Abdul Janadi. He was really sweet, a really kind man. And I went to see him and I said, I want to get permission to film in Sana'a. And he said, do you want to film the protests? I said, no, we're here. We want to do a film about tourism in Yemen. We're probably going to do a lot of filming in the old city. We might walk through those protests to get somewhere else, but we're not going to film the protests. And he said, no, if you film the protests, you really need to interview my son. And I said, sorry? And he said, yeah, my son is leading the protests against Ali Abdullah Saleh, and I really want him to be interviewed by the international media. And I was so confused. I was like, so your son is protesting against the president that you're basically the mouthpiece of? And he said, yes. And so that was my first film. My first documentary was about Abdul Janadi, the Deputy Minister of Information, the man who went on Yemeni TV every single day speaking in support of Ali Abdullah Saleh, the man who spoke about, you know, he would cover up some of the atrocities that were happening in Change Square. And I also followed his son, Abu Dhar al-Janadi, who was the man leading the protests. He was the second, the younger generation, leading the protests. He was there when the Friday of Dignity happened, when 50 people were killed in that road of protesters by Ali Abdullah Saleh. And it was a really fascinating film. But also, I think when I look back at that time, I think about how easy it was to get that permission to film. You know, this wasn't because he wanted me to interview his son. We were able to go out to the streets and do filming. You know, cameras weren't seen as a weapon. Cameras in Yemen right now are seen as a weapon. You can't go out with your camera. You can't even pick up your phone and walk across the streets, because you'll have someone come within moments asking if you have accreditation, and you'll be in big trouble if you don't. So, you know, it was, I don't want to say that, you know, it was very open and you were free to express whatever you wanted. Of course not. We just spoke about 50 people who were killed in Change Square for protesting against the president. But the state of the media climate at the time was very different to what it is now. So I filmed that film about Abdu al-Janadi. I got to interview the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, on that trip. I got to spend lots of time in the protests, filming with those protesting against him. And that's how I made my first film. And I also went on to make two other films at the time about counterterrorism policies in Yemen, and also a film about the Houthis, who, as you all know, are very important players in Yemen right now. Now, back then in 2011, the media climate was a lot easier than it is now, but President Ali Abdullah Saleh definitely had some red lines that you weren't allowed to cross. And one of those red lines was speaking to the Houthis. The Houthis were a group in the far north, originating in the far north of Yemen in a city called Sada. They are a militant group that are that receive some support from Iran. I don't want to exaggerate their support. I think it's too exaggerated in the media. They are Zaydi Shias and are more aligned with the Shiism of Iran than Zaydis that are, you know, because the majority of Yemenis are Zaydis, but the Zaydism that the Houthis follow is very particular and different to the Zaydism that's followed by the majority of Yemenis in northern Yemen. So I went to Sada and to go, I'd heard about the Houthis and I was told, you know, you may be able to film here and to film the protests, but the people you won't be able to film with are the Houthis. They're in Sada and they've had six wars waged against them by Ali Abdullah Saleh. And no international media has ever been able to reach them. And that's because Ali Abdullah Saleh had put 10 checkpoints towards Sada. And only people who were from Sada were able to enter the city or to leave the city. So I met a Houthi in Sana'a, and he said I could pretend to be his wife and that he would take me to Sada. And so 19-year-old me decided that was the next place I wanted to go. And so I wore this full niqab and I hid a handycam underneath my abaya, and we went to Sada, and it was the first time that I met with the Houthi leadership. And back then, they were only around 20,000 fighters. This was the end of 2010. And so I made a film about the Houthis then. And I'm telling you about this because I want to set the scene of what the Houthis later became. And when you hear about them now, hopefully you'll have some context to where they came from and how things have changed so dramatically for them over the last 10 years. So I made that film, and then I came back to London. And, you know, I'm really lucky as a Yemeni journalist because unlike all the other Yemeni journalists on the ground, I get to do these things, cause a bit of trouble, and then fly back to London. And then these films come out and I'm really safe in my flat in London. And, you know, sometimes all hell breaks loose, but I'm in London, so it's fine for me. And usually the people who really face the consequences of some of the films I make are the locals who I couldn't make these films without, who support me on the ground, teach me everything I know, support me in shooting everything and getting to places. You know, I'm really lucky that I get to travel back to a safe place. So I went back to London, and as I was editing all this material from my travels, Ali Abdullah Saleh, and you know, at the time, the protests, as I was filming these films, the protests were still going on in Sana'a, and they were getting very heated, and you know, people were so desperate for change. So when I went back to the UK, and I'm really fast-forwarding events, by the way, Ali Abdullah Saleh was caught up in an attack on a mosque in the presidential palace. And then within a few months, he reemerged and he handed over power in a GCC deal, GCC brokered deal, to his deputy, Vice President Hadi, and kind of took a back seat for a little while. And President Hadi took over, and something called the National Dialogue emerged. And what the National Dialogue was a group of politicians, civil society members, people who were in those protests and led those protests, came together and were writing up a new constitution for Yemen. Now, for 2 years, as this National Dialogue was happening, I think, you know, a lot of journalists, this was one of the final moments, I think, the final 2 years, where you had such a diverse array of journalists from all over the world reporting on Yemen. I had so many friends from, you know, Norwegian journalists, American journalists, British journalists, journalists from across Yemen able to work in Sana'a, reporting on different political events that were happening and having the freedom to do so. So a lot of those journalists were based inside the Mövenpick Hotel, where this National Dialogue was happening, a very lavish hotel. And people were getting paid very well to take part in these discussions for the new constitution. And after spending a little while there, it got quite repetitive and boring. And so I wanted to go outside the Mövenpick Hotel and talk to the people, you know, the people on the ground, about what they thought about what was happening in the Mövenpick Hotel. And, you know, while all these people were there, the economy was crashing. This idea that change was happening and a better day was coming, people were losing patience. Because when the economy was crashing, people were suffering. You know, they were starting to struggle to feed their families. They were struggling to make ends meet. There was frustration about salaries. There was a really growing frustration across the country from civilians. And whilst this was happening in Yemen, we also saw huge change happening in Saudi Arabia. King Abdullah died, and he was replaced by King Salman, and then Mohammed bin Salman, who we now call MBS, became the Minister of Defense, I think, yeah. There was a lot of change in Saudi Arabia, and one crucial decision was made in Saudi Arabia, and that was that they were going to lift the subsidies off of fuel in Yemen. So Saudi Arabia had subsidized fuel for Yemen for many years. And so they had decided that they wanted to stop that. So they lifted the subsidies off of fuel. And this had a devastating effect in Yemen. It just meant not only that fuel had become incredibly expensive, but that had a ripple down effect across all goods. You know, if fuel is expensive, so is food, so is water. And it just became intolerable for the people on the ground. And so the Houthis saw this as an opportunity. Remember the 20,000 men that I told you up north? You know, I'm saying 20,000, by the way, it's very debated. Some people say 20,000, 40,000, but they definitely weren't as many as they are now. They saw this as an opportunity. They started protesting, calling for the subsidies on fuel to be brought back. So they marched from north, the far north in Sada, and started making their way towards Sana'a. And as they marched, people started joining them because they agreed with their call. You know, they were suffering. They could no longer afford basic food. And so these protests grew and grew, and they marched all the way to Sana'a. And people weren't joining them because they believed in their ideology. They weren't suddenly becoming, 12er Shias. They joined the Houthis because they agreed with them that things needed to change, that these subsidies needed to be brought back, that the government needed to take notice that the economy was crashing and that people on the ground were suffering whilst they were all in the Mövenpick Hotel. And so they marched all the way to Sana'a, and it actually just so happened that I was in Yemen at the time looking for Farouk Abdelhak, doing research for the Martina film. And so they marched all the way to Sana'a, and when they got to Sana'a, they went into state institutions, they took them over. They also surrounded the president's home, and they put him under house arrest. And suddenly, Sana'a was practically under lockdown. These Houthis were taking control of the entire capital city. It was a very critical time and things were very tense. And you could just see how things were changing just by driving through the roads. You know, we saw, I remember driving around to a friend's house and suddenly these random checkpoints emerged in Sana'a, and they had these armed young men, very young men, I'm talking 16, 15 years old, which was very, you know, not the usual scene in Sana'a. And the Houthis, they, you know, they were taking control of the entire city. I left when the situation, and actually that night, I remember just before leaving, my father and my father-in-law, my father came to say goodbye to me. They were having a conversation about what was going on in Sana'a. And my father's a diplomat, so he's always very hopeful and optimistic, and things are going to get better. So he said, this is temporary, you know. The Houthis will leave. Maybe this will really make President Hadi take notice that things have to change and he needs to take action. And then my father-in-law, who is a politician, was a minister in Yemen, had spent a lot of time with Ali Abdullah Saleh and the people around him. He said, no, there's going to be a war. There's no way the Saudis are going to allow the Houthis at their doorstep in these numbers. War is going to break out. And I remember thinking, oh, he's such a pessimist. That's not going to happen. And so I left back to London. And within a few days of that, war broke out. I woke up to the news that a 10-nation coalition had started bombing Yemen. Not only that, but that Yemen was on, you know, under a complete lockdown. There was a blockade that had basically stopped the airspace from operating at all. There were no flights in and out of Yemen. And also a blockade on the ports, so no goods could come in, no one could go out. And so essentially, 26 million Yemenis were trapped in Yemen as this bombing campaign was happening. And, you know, I was kind of torn apart, torn into two, between being a journalist who so desperately wanted to just do some phone bashing, get people on the ground to start filming for me and to cover what was going on. But then at the same time, my family were trapped in Yemen. And so I desperately wanted to get them evacuated. Our home was one of the most bombed out, was in one of the most bombed out areas in Yemen, an area called Faj'atan. Where was I? Yeah, so, you know, I was desperately trying to get them evacuated, I was also trying to figure out ways in which I could go into Yemen to start reporting. And so luckily, when there was a small window of opportunity about 4 weeks into the war, I was able to get them evacuated. But, you know, just as they got out of Yemen, that also meant I had one opportunity to get in. And I took that opportunity and I went into Yemen to report on the bombing campaign that was going on at this time. And as soon as I arrived, something had changed. I went in with a group of British journalists, excuse me, a reporter, a senior reporter from the BBC came in with me, and we went into Yemen. And as soon as we landed in Yemen, someone came to pick us up and he said, hi, I'm a delegate from the Houthis and we're going to take you to the Taj Sheba Hotel and we're going to have a briefing about what you're allowed to film and what you're not allowed to film on this trip. And so that lovely man that I met in the Ministry of Information that wanted me to film his son, this was a very different dynamic, a very different conversation. We went to the hotel. There were two armed minders, and we were told that these people were going to accompany us wherever we go, that there were red lines on what we could say and what we couldn't say, that they would watch the people we're interviewing, and that basically we had to focus on the bombing and the damage the bombing was creating, but we had to be really careful about reporting anything against the Houthis. And then what I came to realize is, had we, you know, if we did do anything against the Houthis in this reporting, it was these minders that would end up culpable because they were given the responsibility of watching everything we were doing. And so that just gives you an idea how immediately, within days of these men taking control of Sana'a, how the climate for media changed. And so we, you know, we filmed, we stayed there for a couple of weeks, and it was absolutely horrific. You know, there is nothing worse than seeing your home country being destroyed systematically, in like basically real time. We went to schools that were bombed, we visited hospitals that were bombed, we went to entire neighborhoods that were leveled. And we were working nonstop, just trying to report, trying to gather stories. And, you know, it was incredibly devastating. But even more devastating than that was watching how the Houthis were using this as a tool to recruit and to kind of grow their forces. They were being seen as this national force on the ground that was fighting against this foreign aggression that was bombing from the air. So they were recruiting young people, they were recruiting child soldiers, older people. Anyone who was impacted by this bombing was so angry that they didn't know how else to fight back than to join the Houthis. So if we were talking about 20 to 40,000, you know, depending on where you look, it's between 20 to 40,000 men in 2009. They were growing at alarming numbers, and they were using this aggression in northern Yemen in order to recruit. But it wasn't just bombing. The blockade had a devastating effect on the humanitarian situation, and we were starting to hear stories of pockets of famine across Yemen. And honestly, at the time, the UN would say these things, but I couldn't believe it. I couldn't see it. And we kept, you know, look, in Sana'a at the time, it wasn't appearing. And so after the team left, I decided to travel to where the blockade was, you know, to the Hodeidah port. The Hodeidah port is a really important port. It's where most of 90% of Yemen's food and fuel comes into the country. And as soon as the war started, the Saudi coalition bombed all the cranes in that port, which meant none of this was coming in. And the impact could be seen very quickly in a place called Hodeidah. The war has been at a stalemate for nearly 8 years now. The Houthis have a very tight grip on northern Yemen. They too are responsible for, you know, the humanitarian situation. We've seen people in the public sectors, doctors, teachers, no one has been paid in the last couple of years. People are having to make impossible choices. You know, on my last trip, I spoke to a mother who told me that she had to decide whether to feed the entire family today or to take her very sick child to hospital. She definitely couldn't afford to do both, and she was trying to figure out which one she was going to do. If she didn't take her child to hospital, she was almost certain he wasn't going to survive. But then if she did, all her other children would have to go hungry that day. And, you know, her case is not an isolated case. This has become all too common in Yemen. But I want to take this back to freedom of expression and how it's become so much more difficult to do our work in Yemen. I mentioned to you that when I was in 2015, that the Houthis had taken control. Well, now they are stronger than ever. They have a very tight grip on northern Yemen, and it's very hard to see a situation in which that's going to change in the near future. They've had all these years of recruiting and consolidating power. They killed the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was their partner in crime for many years, and they've taken complete control of the north. And now that they have taken complete control of the north, it's become almost impossible to do any journalism or to do any proper work from inside the country. A lot of the work that I've done that is critical of the Houthis, I've had to rely on locals to do a lot of filming for me, and then we broadcast it without mentioning their names. You know, last year alone, they raided at least 6 radio stations in Sana'a and they shut them down. They've imprisoned multiple journalists, but last year they imprisoned 8 and they put 4 of them on death row after unfair trial. And these are journalists that, you know, I've seen their work. The reason why they're on death row is because they've done work that is critical of the Houthis. This is... And, you know, in the south, I talk a lot about the north because I'm from the north and a lot of my reporting has been focused on northern Yemen. I have done reporting from the south, but not as extensively as I have in the north. And in the south, the forces that are in control of the south, which are the internationally recognized government and the STC, the Southern Transitional Council, these are forces that are backed by the UAE. You know, they've also been accused of harassing and threatening and arbitrarily detaining and prosecuting individuals for peacefully exercising their right to freedom of expression. I mean, the internationally recognized government summoned for investigation and arbitrarily detained at least 7 journalists and activists last year alone. And we're seeing this, you know, it's become commonplace. Just last month, I released an investigation that I'd been working on for around 4 years now. And it's about an assassination program that was led by the STC. And the assassination program was targeting civil society members, government officials, imams, activists, and journalists who were speaking against the authorities on the ground. So it has become an incredibly hostile environment, and it's very hard to see how the situation will improve anytime soon. Thank you.